Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Here's your hosts, Jazz and David.
Welcome everyone to the show once again. We have got Martin North from DFA. Martin, welcome to the show, mate.
Hello there, good to see you again.
It's good. It's been, I think, roughly about 8 or 9 months when we last had you on the show. It was a pleasure last time. A lot of numbers that we discussed. And this time it's going to be a little bit different. But before we jump into the bits that we'll be discussing today, Martin, maybe you just want to give listeners a quick background on your stuff.
Yeah, sure. So digital finance analytics has been around for a long, long time. And we do three things. We survey households and businesses so we get primary information about how they're faring across Australia. Secondly, we get a lot of information from both local and international sources to try and understand what's going on more broadly in terms of the financial system and how that all plays out. And then thirdly, we do modeling. And that modeling then allows us to create points of view. And those points of view go out on our digital finance analytics blog, our YouTube channels, and through social media. And we also do work for clients as well. But it's all trying to understand the financial system, how it's working, how it impacts real businesses and real households. And at the moment, of course, we're right in the middle of a crisis. So it's pretty busy.
Awesome. Awesome part is that you guys are busy, but we are in the crisis, not the best part of it. So I just want to get that right. But Martin, the main purpose of our podcast today was there's a couple of new terms that have been thrown around in the last couple of months. One was the repo operations. I first time ever heard about that. There's a thing called repo in September last year when it was started. Don't know whether it's happened before that or not. And the other one was the swap lines, which happened around March this year, part of the COVID when Fed started the swap lines, right? And I don't have much understanding of either. So I'm bringing the best person to explain that to us, right? You can decide which one you want to touch on first, whichever makes sense. But help educate us a little bit on both the repo market and the swap lines. And then we'll see how we go.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, at one level, this sounds horribly complicated and there's lots of jargon and all those things. But at another level, it's really quite simple. And it's all to do with the financial system plumbing that underpins our financial system globally. Right. Because if you think about it, we have banks and we have hedge funds and we have insurance companies, all of those all financial services organizations all offering all sorts of products and services. But they all are supported by flows of what's called liquidity. In other words, access to funds, and that liquidity then gets converted into all sorts of assets like bonds and those sorts of things. So underpinning the real world is this financial system, right? And that financial system is very much controlled by the central banks around the world, like the Reserve Bank in Australia and the Federal Reserve in the US and the Bank of England and Bank of Japan. And in fact, it's the global structure of those central banks that really is underpinning the activity in the financial system and the financial plumbing, because what they're worried about is a withdrawal of liquidity. So in other words, if banks, for example, can't get the funding that they need to make loans, then they have to dial back their lending activity, and that then puts downward pressure on the broader economy. And back in 2007, 2008, through the global financial crisis, it was fundamentally a liquidity crisis, right? In other words, banks couldn't get the funding they needed, the financial system froze, banks didn't trust each other, and we saw the results of that, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, with very significant falls in the value of banks, the value of economic activity, and therefore the recession that they had in various parts of the world. So there is a big concern to try and maintain liquidity in the financial system. Now, to do that, you have a bunch of different tools. And the Federal Reserve will say, we have lots of different tools that we can use, and we will use those tools without limit to ensure the liquidity in the financial system. And you could say, well, give me an example. Quantitative easing is one example, which is basically just putting more money in the system and more money in the system and more money in the system to keep it all flowing, right? Now, of course, what happens to the real economy as a result of that is another debate for another time. But as part of this liquidity set of processes, right, there are two very important terms. The first is the repo or repurchase market. And the second, which we'll come on to a little later to do with the swap lines, but let's touch on the repo markets. Now, the way the repo market works is, if you think about a financial institution, and when they close off their books at the end of that, you know, they've done a lot of trading and they've bought and sold and all the things, they close off their books. The last thing they want to be doing is sitting on vast amounts of cash, because cash doesn't earn anything, right? And so what tends to happen is there are big markets, which are effectively overnight markets, where different financial institutions will effectively true off against each other, right? And effectively, if one has more cash than they need, they might actually put an agreement in place with another organization that needs cash to balance out, and then they will actually effectively make that transaction, net each other off, everyone's happy, and then the next day they'll unwind it. All right. Now, that at its basic level is what a repo is. Basically, it's a repurchase agreement between two parties, right? And they can be done and undone, most often overnight, but not doesn't have to be overnight, but quite often are. And there will be a price for that transaction, and that price effectively is the return. So the people with the money effectively gets a little bit of return when it's actually unwound, right? Now, generally, those repo markets are actually secured with assets that have the highest quality of ratings, like, for example, government bonds and those sorts of things. So they tend to be based on secure assets, which means there's no risk of those assets blowing up. And so it's a very safe and secure and low-risk way of truing off the balances. Now, that's sort of the basic point. But what happened last September, particularly in the US, but beyond that as well, was we had essentially the rates moving from where they should have been to very high rates. And this was an early sign, essentially, of liquidity crisis in the financial system. And the Fed, therefore, started going into the market and effectively behaving like a counterparty within the repo market. In other words, they could buy and sell whatever assets they wanted at the price that they determined, right, to push rates down. So think of the normal market operating, you know, the normal repo markets working, and then the Fed came in and say, right, we're going to put the rate down here, right, and we're going to buy as much of it as anybody wants. And because, of course, the rate's lower, the banks would prefer to put the assets that they got them with them because it costs them less. So that's essentially what happened. And so the repo market is therefore now being used as a control mechanism by the central banks, particularly the Fed, to depress rates. Right? And so now we had that massive blow up in the repo market in September. And by the way, let's be clear, the current financial crisis that we have around the world, and we do have a financial crisis, is not triggered by COVID, right? The traps were laid post-2007 and probably earlier, right? It was just that COVID created effectively a set of circumstances to reveal it. It was already happening. Mm-hmm. And it's important people understand that. So this is a long-term issue. It's to do with the fact that we've got too much financial liquidity flowing around the system. We've got too much quantitative easing going, all of those things, right? And so the repo markets are a mechanism that central banks, not just in the Fed but otherwise, can now start setting rates. Because the more they intervene, the more they take rates down, the more than they can drive the rate at which transactions happen. And in fact, if you think about it, and if you actually have enough activity from the central banks, they can effectively control what's called the yield curve. In other words, the price of money out over a longer term period. And that's precisely what the Reserve Bank here in Australia is doing and the Fed is doing to drive rates lower, right? Because they want target rates to be 0.25% or whatever it is, and very low rates, right? Mm-hmm. And the repo market is essentially one of those critical mechanisms by which they can control long-term and short-term interest rates through the yield curve and through the repos. Now, the other thing the Fed did was not only did they do overnight repos, in other words, like I said, take money overnight, take assets overnight, turn them back the next day, they actually then did term repos as well, right? Which basically meant you had that transaction on the books for, you know, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it was, right? And those term repos are another element within this structure, because basically it gives them yet more control out over the yield curve. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what happened since last September, the Fed has increased their balance sheet overall. It's now more than $7 trillion US dollars, right? And it's up by something like 78% from where it was before the repo crisis. So you can see that there's been this massive liquidity flow, and essentially the repo is right at the heart of it in terms of the mechanism they use to be able to actually control interest rates, control liquidity, support the financial system, stop the banks falling over, and probably drowning the rest of the economy around the world with more liquidity. So that's the repo. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, do you have any questions on repo before I go on to the other one?
Yes, I surely do. So in absolute layman's term, what's the risk that it's highlighting when you start making repo operations?
Yeah, so repos have been around for years and years and years and years, right? So it's a fundamental part of the way that the banking system works. You know, you don't want to sit on cash, right? Like I said, what you want to be able to do is to get a return on that cash, and by effectively finding people who need the cash, you can actually true it off, everybody wins, and essentially there's no risk in the system, right? So the fundamental principle of repo is not fundamentally risk-based, right? It is a very, well-practiced mechanism. It's been around for years and years and years. It's been used widely. And so at its heart, it isn't risky. Yeah. But when you actually then have the Federal Reserve, for example, effectively interfering and setting the rate in the repo market, and the Reserve Bank is doing it here in Australia, right? It's the mechanism then that the central banks are using to control interest rates, right? Mm-hmm. And so then you start questioning, well, hang on a moment, why are they doing that? You know, and is what they're doing sensible? And that's a different question, right? So the risk is not in the repo itself. The risk is actually in the intent behind using repos as a mechanism to achieve an end.
Okay.
And then, so the big question is, do we think there are central banks are actually onto a good wicket in terms of actually dealing with the financial issues that we have around the world? Or do we think that essentially they have potentially lost the plot? And, you know, my own view is they keep pumping more and more liquidity into the system. They use quantitative easing, they use the repos and all those sorts of things as part of the mechanism. And by the way, if you look in the Fed now has something like 14 different programs, right? Tackling all sorts of different classes of assets. They're looking to buy bonds, even junk bonds, for example. They're looking to buy EFTs. They're looking to buy commercial paper. They're looking, basically, the Fed is buying up pretty much anything. And they can do that because, of course, what they're doing is getting liquidity from the US Treasury. And so basically, they're lifting both sides of the balance sheet. You know, the Treasury issues bonds. The Fed buys the bonds, you know, and so this mechanism is, and that's the risk. So the risk is not on repos itself. Mm-hmm. The risk is how they're used in the context of the broader financial system, the plumbing, and the strategy behind it. And I think that the risks are accelerating. And frankly, we could well be looking at a global economy that is looking more and more like Japan is, because Japan has been at its quantitative easing stuff for a lot longer than anybody else. And if you look carefully, they're actually having asset deflation. So prices of property is down. The Bank of Japan owns something like 40% of the total Japanese economy now. 40% of the total economy, right? Because they've been buying assets and shares and everything, right? They've been buying stock markets shares as well as part of their process of liquidity purchase. So that's the risk. So the risk is not repos itself. The risk is actually what it signals in terms of the distress in the financial system, the financial plumbing, and to what extent are the responses from the central bankers sensible and moderated and appropriate, or to what extent are they just pushing it and trying to do whatever they can to try and keep the liquidity there? The problem I have is this is all about supporting the financial system, right? And, you know, banks around the world are getting plenty of liquidity so they can lend more if they want to. And so we're increasing the amount of debt in the system. We're increasing the amount of government securities in the system, more and more moral debt. The question is, can that go on forever, or is there ultimately going to be a point at which the whole thing just falls flat on its face? And we don't know, because this is an experiment. Nobody's ever done this before, right? And the views, I think, of many people are that they'll go on doing it because they can't stop. They did try. So if you look at the Fed, they actually did try to turn down their quantitative easing, and they used their manipulation of the markets to be able to start taking it down. But then the markets came roaring back and said, no, we want some more liquidity. And the Fed had to return to the quantitative easing, and have now more than $7 trillion. So that's the risk.
Right. So just quickly, Japan obviously has traveled this path, right? How do we see, what lessons have they learned that we know are going to be problem in the future of doing all this, basically?
Well, Japan has gone as far as trying negative interest rates. They've tried buying all sorts of assets of all sorts of types. And yet they have not been able to resurrect inflation. Right, so inflation is still very low in Japan. Asset prices are falling, and they are really out of ammo. So I think probably the lesson from Japan is the strategy isn't necessarily going to work. And by the way, the Eurozone is also following a similar path. They're ahead of the US because they've actually got negative interest rates in some parts of the Eurozone now. And again, now people are saying, well, actually, negative interest rates and all this quantitative easing is actually damaging the financial system, not supporting it, because effectively if rates come really low, banks stop lending because they can't make any money from lending, right? Mm-hmm. And it also means that banks then try to take more aggressive speculative positions to try and actually generate returns. So in fact, they expose themselves to more risks and more derivatives risks and those sorts of things. So whether you look at Japan or whether you look at the Eurozone, the conclusion you draw is that you don't want to go negative interest rates, right? Unlimited quantitative easing doesn't take you anywhere good, and it doesn't necessarily lead to inflation. Remember that central banks around the world generally target inflation of between 2 and 3%. And we have been below that for years and years and years in almost every economy around the world, and people are puzzled by that. Why is it that when you do all this QE and everything else, you don't get inflation, right? People haven't understood why that is. Japan doesn't understand why it is, right? Now, it could be to do with the fact that you've got so much globalization going on, so that effectively operations are moved to other low-cost centers of manufacture rather than doing it locally. It could be to do with the rise of, computers and automation, all those things, and therefore productivity is, just different from where it was previously. It could be the fact that wages are much more fragile now and people are more on gig roles than elsewhere. So, all of those things are part of the story as to why inflation is stubbornly low. But there's an interesting, more fundamental question, which is, well, actually, is targeting a 2 to 3% inflation rate sensible now, given where we are? And second, how are we measuring inflation in the first place? And quite often the way that inflation is being measured is wrong. So they've actually taken out, for example, housing from the inflation calculation. And they've done a bunch of other things to artificially, in my view, artificially state what inflation is. Because if you talk to real people in Australia, say, they'll say, well, actually, cost of living have been rising quite fast in recent years. And yet the official statistic doesn't show that. So there's a bunch of complications there. And all of those, laid bare in Japan. I think we can learn a lot of things as to what not to do. I don't think they give us a very good set of lessons in terms of what we should be doing. And interesting, of course, Phil Lowe has said he's not going to go into negative interest rates at this stage. Interesting to see whether he can maintain that position, because my theory is that if Japan is sort of first cab off the rank and then the Eurozone is second cab off the rank, we are following on behind the Fed. But actually, in 2 to 3 years' time, we'll probably have no choice but to take rates negative, because there will be no resurgence of inflation, in my view. And so all of this liquidity that's being thrown in the system is effectively not meeting the objective that it was put there to do in the first place.
Yeah. So you mentioned deflation with Japan, right? Obviously, and we all know that, right? Yeah. What does that mean for Australia? I mean, do we see deflation coming here? And what are some of the impacts of deflation, good and bad?
Yeah. Now, this is a really, really interesting, and nobody knows, right? Because you can, there are two futures, right? There is a future of inflation. So all this liquidity and all this quantitative easing, all this money that's flowing into the system, right? If it flows into the real economy, it could actually put the price of everything up, and you could suddenly start getting inflation like you had in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, you can quote other countries around the world where they've seen that, right? And then the currency collapses and, you know, you turn to Zimbabwe or something, right? Now, that is one future. And there are many economists who still believe that that is probably where we're going to end up. However, there's a couple of reasons why I'm not quite so convinced. The first is all of this liquidity is not going into the real economy. It's going into the financial system. So it's effectively inflating financial assets, and it's essentially pumping up that sector of the economy, but it's not hitting the real economy, right? So if you look at, for example, what the Fed has done with their $7 trillion, very little of it is actually coming back into the real economy and going into the pockets of real households and real businesses. And if that continues, you may not get inflation, right? And if you don't get inflation and you don't get economic activity, then you start seeing asset prices and also the cost of things dropping. Wages don't go up. If wages don't go up, costs of manufacturing can go down. And so you can end up with an alternative future, which is a deflationary sort of scenario, which basically then goes into a long, slow, negative grind, which is extremely hard to get out of. And in that situation, by the way, you know, one of the reasons why this is quite interesting, because if you think the future is going to be inflationary, then people say, well, I need to hold gold because gold will hold its value and will give me certainty in an uncertain world, right? But in a deflationary environment, actually gold is not a sensible thing to hold on to, because in a deflationary world, the price of gold goes down. So it shows you that, you know, these things have real life consequences. I don't know which of those two futures it's going to be. And frankly, the problem is that laying a forward path for deflation rather than inflation requires very different strategies. So it's really hard to know that much. So I'm watching the early indicators to see which way this is going to go. Is it going to go up or is it going to go down? It may well be that we go down a bit and then it goes up, or it may be more likely, I think, that we actually wobble along and then deflationary pressures really start to bite. And then that downward spiral just takes us into a rather uncomfortable place. So my own personal view is we're probably more likely to end up within a deflationary future than an inflationary future, but not sure.
Okay. Do you want to touch on swap lines and explain that as well, maybe?
Okay. So now, going back to the fundamental question about the financial plumbing. The financial plumbing is international in nature, right? So we're not just talking about money inside one economy. We're talking about the financial flows across economies. And the lion's share of the international transactions are transacted in US dollars, right? So the US dollar is essentially a reserve currency in the sense that it is the one that's underpinning all other currencies and most of the transactions. Now, there have been various attempts to, you know, replace it with the yuan on China or whatever else, but no, the US dollar is the fundamental reserve currency. Now, the point here is that in a liquidity crisis, access to US dollars might become a problem, because suddenly you might find that people don't want to actually transact across international borders because they're not sure about the risks on the other side, right? So one of the things that the Fed did was to announce an extension of their swap lines. Now, they've had swap lines with a number of central banks in other countries for some time, but they've extended them. So, you know, Australia's got a swap line, the UK's got a swap line, the Eurozone's got a swap line, Japan's got a swap line with the US. And what it basically says is, at any point, there will be free flow of US dollars such that if anybody needs US dollars, the Fed will provide US dollars in exchange for local currency. So that means you can think of it like a firm in Japan needing to access US dollars. They can go to the Bank of Japan. The Bank of Japan can go to the Fed on their swap line. They can pull those US dollars across and then effectively convert them and provide them to the local economy in Japan. So that's how it works, right? So it's a way of ensuring that US liquidity is spread across where it needs to be spread. And interestingly, if you look at the mix of swap lines at the moment, the more than half of all those swap lines that have been actually sent has gone to Japan. right? And another great chunk has gone to the Eurozone. I think Australia took about $1 billion US, you know, hardly anything, right? So we've just got a little bit. And many other countries never actually used the swap lines at all. So there was never the crisis, the access to US dollar crisis. So it's fundamentally one, providing access to US dollars. And basically those swap lines are then converted back. So effectively nobody loses, because essentially it's just done at the agreed rate, but it's moving exchange from one currency to US dollars and back again. Mm-hmm. And that's what the swap lines are. And the other thing to say is, of course, that if you think about it, that gives the Fed quite a lot of control in terms of the price of the US dollar, right? Because they can actually start influencing the flows of US dollars through the financial plumbing again. So it's another tool in their armory. It's effectively another way of controlling the financial system. It's another way of setting the price of the US dollar and ensuring that there is no liquidity crisis in US dollar terms in other countries. And because it's this reserve currency, it effectively, again, protects the global financial system from potential disaster, where if liquidity stops, as I said at the beginning, then things go really bad. So that, in a way, and simply put, is what swap lines are.
Okay. So both are providing liquidity in the market, but just to different parties, essentially. One to the banks. One is more between the banks. The other is more between the countries.
Yeah, it's between the central banks. So the swap lines are between central banks, you know, of Bank of Japan or the Euro, you know, ECB or the Bank of England and the Fed. And interestingly, that they report on. So the Fed is quite transparent, actually, in what it's doing. So they report weekly on their balance sheet, so you can see what their total balance sheet movement is. And they also provide quite a lot of granularity in terms of who's got the swap lines, how much is where, and those things. So there's a lot of disclosure and transparency, but you're right. The repo markets is fundamentally liquidity between the major financial players. The swap lines are access to US dollars cross-country, cross-border. And, you know, if I'm a central bank in, let's say, Japan again, it allows me to get access to US dollars if my, you know, companies in Japan needs them, right? So it supports the international conduit of trade, it supports the US dollar, and again, but it's all part of this same liquidity story.
Okay, cool. This thing that we were discussing before starting the recording, which is, if every central bank in the world is doing a QE, then does it even matter that much? Do you want to touch on that a little bit of, I mean, if everyone is just printing money, what's the difference and what does that mean?
Yeah, and there's a big interesting debate here, because of course people will say, well, hang on a moment, if I'm in one country and I'm doing a lot of quantitative easing, then do I kill my currency, right? And if one country does it, yeah, you could, because essentially suddenly the value of, you know, what you're doing, if you think about, you know, my economy is this big in terms of its value, and I've just doubled the amount of liquidity, you're going to effectively halve the equivalent value per dollar. So you would expect the, you know, the price to fall. But if everybody's doing it, and if everybody's effectively following the same script, and, you know, central banks tend to work together, they've got this thing called the Bank for International Settlements, where they'll get around, you know, the virtual table or the real table and effectively plot how they're going to actually take this forward. So there's a very strong groupthink amongst the central bankers. They're all doing the same stuff. So in a way, most central banks, particularly, you know, those in the Western part of the economy, are following a similar path. Now, if that is the case, then you don't get this differential movement necessarily between one currency and another currency. And therefore, it may just be that you're just basically just lifting the all the boats in the harbor and everything just goes higher and higher and higher, and it doesn't necessarily achieve a huge amount other than just more liquidity, right? But what it does do is it means that the financial system can continue to tick over, and, you know, banks can lend more, so that means you can put more households into debt and you can put more businesses into debt, and you can try and encourage the banks to actually lend more to customers. So we're seeing a lot, in even in Australia, of people being encouraged to take more debt on, right? Now there's a point at which, of course, you can't take more debt on because you can't repay it, but that's another story, right? So yeah, so if everybody's doing that, everybody's following the same trajectory and everybody's thinking the same about it, then differentially you might not actually see a huge amount of damage on one economy. What you will see potentially is that the global system just, you know, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the amount of debt in the system has grown dramatically in recent times. You know, it's hard to know precisely what the latest figures are, but you know, it's billions and billions and billions of debt that's been increasing. And if you go back to the global financial crisis and what the level of debt was there, it's a lot lower then and where we are now. And globally, if you count up all the debt, so corporate debt, the debt amongst countries, the debt amongst central banks, you know, we have never had more debt in the system. And, you know, my own concern is that we don't understand the implications of this. Because remember, the thing about debt is that ultimately the capital has to be repaid by somebody at some point in the future. Now you can kick the can down the road and you can refinance the debt, et cetera, et cetera. And with interest rates really low, doesn't necessarily cost a lot, but you have to pay it back. And that's the real question. So I come back to my, you know, dilemma here, which is, well, if everybody's inflating their financial systems and putting more liquidity in the system using these various tools, and therefore the amount of debt in the system is rising and rising and rising, what is the consequence of that, right? And I'm not sure anybody knows, because this is an experiment which has never been done before.
But how can you refinance the debt when the interest rates are already at zero?
Well, it's interesting. There was a gilt, in other words, the UK government bond was issued with a negative interest rate. So, in fact, they actually got money for free.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why people are talking about negative interest rates, because what it basically means is that governments can pretty much then not have to pay anything for the funds they get. But they still have to. They're still holding the capital. They still have to repay the capital at some time in the future, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, because you can go on issuing more new debt and then, you know, pay the old debt off and then issue the new debt. But the question is, just is that really an infinite machine? You know, can you just go on doing it forever and ever and ever and ever and ever? Or mm-hmm. are there consequences, right? And, you know, there are consequences. There are consequences in terms of, you can support the financial system, but are you supporting the real economy? That's the first question. And in many cases, no, we're not supporting the real economy. We're just supporting the financial system, right, and hoping that that financial system will be always there. And so, you know, you'll hear central banks talking about financial stability and the importance of actually having a financial stability system that works well. But real economies aren't necessarily benefiting from that, first point. Second point is, there is a point at which there is so much debt that it will never be repaid unless debt is in some way written off. And, you know, whether it's a debt jubilee, which Steve Keen talks about that quite often, or whether it's some sort of debt forgiveness program or some other mechanism, right? There will be a point, I think, when the debt is unsustainable. Don't know when it's going to be. But at that point, then this whole Ponzi scheme that the central banks have been involved in for at least the last 20-odd years, because I think this is a long-term strategic thing, could actually come unglued. And if it does come unglued, then we are into a new world. Now, there are people saying, well, of course, the answer is going to be, it's going to be, you know, the US dollar is going to be replaced by a digital currency. And, you know, suddenly we're going to find that everything is transformed onto a new financial base. Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, those are just speculative thoughts. But no, the problem at the moment is we're in a one-way street, more QE, more debt, but nobody's figured out how to get out of that one-way street.
Will you call this capitalism or socialism?
Well, to my mind, capitalism is about fair market price, open market transparency, and price discovery. That, to my mind, is what we don't have that. We have a controlled financial system that's heavily regulated, firstly. It's heavily influenced, and I've explained some of the leverages that it used to basically point the system to where people think it should go. We have a lot of unelected central bankers calling all the shots, if you think about it. So there's no democracy here. You know, that Philip Lowe isn't accountable to anybody for his decisions, frankly. And the same with the other central bankers around the world. Interestingly, of course, in the US, the Federal Reserve isn't even owned by, you know, the American government. The Federal Reserve is owned by, guess who? The banks. So you could argue that the Federal Reserve is predominantly interested in preserving the financial system and the financial processes. The Reserve Bank in Australia is owned by the government, so it's not quite the same. But nevertheless, there's a big question of accountability here. And so my own view is that we've got this weird system where everybody is fixated on the financial system, right? and financial stability, and people are losing sight of the real economy. And in fact, the only answer for the real economy, if Australia's a great example, is, oh, well, let's just encourage people to borrow more, let's lift house prices some more, and let's, you know, just keep that housing Ponzi scheme going a bit further, because that basically is directly linked to the amount of liquidity in the system. But it's not actually productive stuff, right? It doesn't actually create a stable, well-crafted, well-designed economy for the future. And that's the concern I have, that there are consequences for all these decisions that people don't fully understand. But central bankers are not accountable to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to quickly touch on some of the mortgage numbers lately?
Sure.
If you have them on top of your, especially the commercial. I'm really keen to know a bit more on commercial with this COVID stuff.
Yeah.
There's obviously a lot changing in the commercial space. So it'll be good to understand with some data insights that you might have.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we know what we know. The commercial sector is under the gun at the moment in Australia. We know that many banks have dialed back their lending to commercial development and even to those firms who are managing commercial operations today. For example, we know that many of the pension funds and superannuation funds who have invested, for example, in the retail spreads that are out there, you know, these big shopping centers, right, are suddenly seeing high vacancy rates. They're seeing very low returns in terms of the rentals. So there's a lot of vacant space. If you walk around any of the retail centers, you'll see there's a lot of pressure there. We also know that now there's a lot of spare capacity in the office space sector. And so rentals for offices are going down, and there's still a lot more construction underway to build more office space. So we've got a supply-demand disequilibrium in retail and also in the office sector. So that is going to put downward pressure on returns for commercial real estate trusts, and it's going to put downward pressure on the future value of commercial real estate. A lot of that is leveraged. So there are, you know, mortgages and other financial mechanisms there to support those. And the question now is, will there be enough returns coming in from the reduced footfall and from the reduced occupancy rates to be able to support the credit that's already there to fund the ongoing development and management of those centres? I have a feeling we're going to see more defaults. I have a feeling that commercial real estate is going to take a bath over the next 12 to 18 months. Even the Reserve Bank has said this in its last stability statement. He said they're more concerned about commercial real estate than about residential real estate, which is quite interesting, right? So this is a big deal. And, you know, on average, banks maybe have, what, 10 or 15% of their book exposed to commercial real estate in some way. But more importantly, our superannuation funds are quite heavily exposed to real estate trusts and to specific projects and programs in the commercial property sector. And they've done quite well until now, but I think that's going to change. So that's why I'm concerned about the commercial sector.
It's funny you said that, because that was my next question. Does that mean that the superannuation funds can have some sort of an impact because of what's happening in the commercial real estate? Because they are more exposed to commercial for obvious reason, which is the rent yields, because the rent yields are obviously much higher.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, no, it's happening at two levels. The first level is they've actually, in some cases, bought into real estate trusts. So that's a diversified pool of, commercial property, right? And if the returns are down, then that is going to be down. But others, some particular superannuation funds, have directly invested into particular projects, right? And they're the ones, because they're not listed, right? So it's hard to know what the true value is. But my own view is that they're the super funds we're going to see a lot of dead wood in and a lot of poor returns. And whilst most super funds will have diversified investment strategies, there will be a proportion of those funds leveraged into the commercial property sector. And I think the returns are going to be shocking. So, yeah, I'd watch for that. And, you know, if I'm in a super fund, I would want to know what proportion of my super fund is actually in commercial real estate, and to what extent is it in diversified real estate trusts, and to what extent is it in one-off projects. And if you're in a superannuation fund with lots of one-off projects, that doesn't bode well, in my view.
Okay. Yeah. Some really good points over there, mate. It will be interesting to see what the numbers look like once this, unless the job keeper, job seeker, and the mortgage suspensions get expanded. But otherwise, if they don't, what the numbers do look like. I think that ends in September, so post-September.
Well, yeah, I mean, we don't know whether it's going to be a cliff or whether it's going to be shaded off, and we don't know whether particular sectors of the market will get more support. My view is it won't be turned off in September. It will have to be shaded down because, by definition, these things are going to take a long time. You know, the Reserve Bank is saying next year unemployment's going to have a 7 in front of it. Right. Before we went into this crisis, unemployment had a 5 in front of it, and the RBA was looking for a 4.5. Mm-hmm. So we know we're going to have higher unemployment. We know we're going to have less household spending more, rather, you know, because they don't have the money and because they're going to be under the gun. We know that wages growth is going to be very low. We know that there's going to be some impact in terms of, you know, costs of goods. So all of that, I think, is going to have a significant impact. And the net view I would have is that the chances of getting past September without any more government support is almost zero. It's just a question of what the shape of that will be.
Yeah, I'm of the same opinion, but this is uncharted waters. You don't know.
Oh, we've never been here before. It's an experiment, right? Yeah. This whole thing is an experiment triggered by COVID. But remember what I said, this is actually a consequence of 20 years of bad policy. Right. So this was always going to happen. It's just that COVID has brought it perhaps earlier than it might have happened.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. On one side, we are launching space rockets into the international space stations. On the other side, we are struggling with the planet Earth.
And by the way, you know, the whole thing about climate transformation and needing to adjust has gone off the agenda. Right. But actually, that's the I would say that the COVID is an appetizer for what we're going to see in the 20, 30, 40 years ahead, unless we get our head around how to actually get the climate under control. Because, you know, some of the things that we've had to do recently, potentially we may have to do forever into the future.
Yeah, I think Elon has already got that figured out, so that's why he's trying to launch into Mars as soon as possible.
Yeah, that's right. Go and build another one, have another go.
That's sort of a joke. But look, Martin, super appreciate your time, mate. That was good to understand some of these terms that have been thrown around lately. I mean, as an individual or an investor who's in this space, all of a sudden starts to hear some of these words which they have never thought of or looked at before, then makes you think how the financial plumbing works, which is what this one is all about, the financial plumbing, right? Any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
Yeah, we just want to say again, you know, there is a lot of jargon around how the financial plumbing works, right? And there's a lot of long, you know, language and everything else, but understand it's fundamentally about flows of money. It is plumbing. Think about liquidity, right? And everything that's being done at the moment is to try and support the financial system. But the question has to be, how does that translate to impacting the real economy? And unfortunately, on that, most central bankers are horribly quiet.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Just one last fun question. AI, how do you see AI affecting humanity over the long run? When I say long run, maybe 20 years.
Well, it's going to definitely have a significant impact. I mean, I think it depends a bit how we choose to use it. I think there are many positive things that could be used and harnessed and, you know, applied to, but it also could be used for negative as well. For example, if we actually end up with, you know, more tracking and more, you know, ability to recognize faces and all those sorts of things. And then, you know, you could see a future state where everything is digitally controlled and, you know, they use the AI systems to be able to track us. And, you know, that's one end, and that will be a very bad place. Unfortunately, we seem to be drifting in that direction. There seems to be very little that people can do about it, but I'm nervous about that. But on the other hand, I think there are many positives, and it could be definitely, it could actually take a lot of drudgery out of some jobs. It could create new insights. And when you actually get to the point, perhaps, of being able to create more new capability more quickly by using some of those capabilities, it has a positive spin too. It's a question of how it's harnessed, I think, rather than it being intrinsically good or bad on its own.
Yeah, that's really good, mate. Appreciate your time. We'll get in touch again at some point once the new numbers come out. on some of the data, especially after these some of these programs, which is a job keeper and job seeker and all. But in the meantime, hope you keep safe. We'll definitely be back soon. Thanks.
Enjoyed the conversation. Take care. Bye-bye.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.